It's Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN. Presented by the Windjammer Restaurant and Upper Deck Pub. Local, fresh, and Burlington's original steak and seafood restaurant. Now, here's your host, Brady Farkas.
What's up, everybody? Brady Farkas, Champlain Valley Game Night right here on a Thursday. May 3rd it is, 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. And we're always streaming on the app, so you can download the 101.3 ESPN app for free in the Google Play Store or in the Apple Store as well. Full show podcasts, access to all of our exclusive interviews, all of our web content as well, scores, schedules, everything you could want is on that 101.3 ESPN app. And if you're using that Amazon Echo, that smart speaker, just tell Alexa to enable 101.3 ESPN, and that's how you will be able to get us from anywhere in your house or where you might be using your Amazon Echo. So we appreciate however you listen, and we thank you for being in. We go up until 7 o'clock today, a full show. Red Sox baseball comes up 7:20, the pregame show, David Price on the mound in Texas. And then over on AM 960, The Zone, it is the Sixers at the Celtics in Game 2 of their series. Celtics have a 1-0 lead in that series. We're still unsure about Jaylen Brown's status for today. We'll keep you updated if we get a definitive answer here over the course of the show. If you want to get in, you can. 802-655-6672. You can do so on the Town Fair Tire text line. Today is an interesting day for me, and we'll talk about this at the end of the show too, but it's an interesting day for me because Ichiro is leaving the Mariners in terms of being on the field, and it's a weird thing. I knew it was going to be awkward when the Mariners re-signed Ichiro. They re-signed him in the offseason, 44 years old. They re-signed him because a number of players were on the DL. They were going to have 1.4 starters, three starters on the DL to start the season, and they ended up with a fourth right after. So there was room for Ichiro, and then I knew that, well, when those guys come back, it's going to get awkward, and it did, and it has. And Ichiro now is going to transition from a playing role to a front office role, but he's not officially retiring. So basically, Ichiro has been given a deal where he will not play the rest of the season. He will not play for the rest of the season, but he will still be a part of the team. He'll travel on all the trips. He'll be with the guys. He'll take batting practice. And if he wants to play again in 2019 for the Mariners or anybody else, he can at age 45. So it's not an official retirement, but it feels like it's pretty darn close to the end. And there's maybe a gimmick. Next year, the Mariners open up in Tokyo. Maybe Ichiro plays two games with the Mariners and says goodbye in Japan. Maybe. It's possible. So maybe it's not the last we've seen of Ichiro, but it feels like it's the last we've seen of Ichiro. So we'll talk about that at the end of the show. I'll just have a couple of quick thoughts on Ichiro and his career with the Mariners. As for what's coming up today, some interesting comments from Julius Erving, who talked about Jason Tatum and Markelle Fultz and what should have been done in the NBA draft. At 6:20, we'll be joined by Bob Black, voice of the Richmond Spiders. You Giant fans will like that because he called the games for Kyle Lauletta, the quarterback that the Giants took in the fourth round of the NFL draft. And as I said, I'll get into Ichiro as well. But first, this is hard for me, but we have to retrain everything that we've ever been told or we've ever thought about pitching. And it stems from, I've been thinking about this for a bit, and I've had a hard time coming to grips with it, but Buster Olney, our ESPN and MLB insider, he joined us yesterday in the huddle, and he kind of put it perfectly. Here's what he said about the shift in pitching, why we need to retrain our minds.
Part of the underlying shift in baseball is, you know, we all grew up with the premise that you pitch off your fastball. You know, yes. The most important pitch is a well-placed fastball. Well, Rich Hill, I think, expressed this better than anybody else. He, of course, a Massachusetts native who pitched with the Red Sox at the end of, 2015, 2016, had some real success. And he told me about conversations he had with Brian Bannister, who works in their front office. And Bannister said, look, if your best pitch is your curveball, which is the case in for Rich Hill, why not throw that the most instead of the fastball?
And that goes counter to everything we've ever been told. And on the surface, it makes sense, right? You want to throw your best pitch more often because your best pitch gives you the chance to get the most outs. So I get it. And look, I was like that too. When I pitched, I wanted to throw my changeup all the time. I've said this a lot. But what happens is that by the time you get to the sixth inning or the time you get to the third time through the order, that changeup's no longer as effective. So what always was my downfall was that my fastball was not good enough to live on to the point you needed it to be. And it's hard for me in the major leagues to wrap my head around this, where the guys are throwing on the low end 90 and on the high end 98 to see guys abandon their fastballs. I mean, Drew Pomeranz threw 92 miles an hour on average last year, and he wants to throw his curveball every other pitch, and that just frustrates me to no end. But Buster Olney is now telling us that that's becoming commonplace, and we need to retrain our mind. Here's why it's been so hard for me, because I look at it and I say, simply, what does establishing your fastball do? Well, for me, what I know it would have done, and for what I've seen it do for people, is it allows you to go deeper in the game. If you can establish your fastball, you can go deeper into the game for a number of reasons. Number one, in a perfect world, the starting pitcher throws seven innings every night, right? In a perfect world, you're a Red Sox fan, you're a Yankee fan, you're a fan of anybody. Your starting pitcher's going seven innings every single night, and your bullpen's getting saved, and you don't have to wear out all the pen. That's a perfect world. Well, in a perfect world, first time through the order, you're getting by on your fastball. And what then happens if you can do that? Well, they haven't seen your off-speed stuff. So the second time through the order, yeah, I got the fastball, and now I've got the curveball that they haven't seen. And the third time through the order, well, I've got the fastball, the curveball, and I've got something else they haven't seen. And it just allows me to be more unpredictable, and I don't have to throw the kitchen sink at them early. I remember pitching against Cortland State, and people on the other side of the lake who follow Plattsburgh will know how good Cortland is. And even if you are, you know, on the extreme kind of southern end of our listenership, you're down at Castleton, and you know how good your team is in baseball, you know how good Cortland is too. They were number one in the country for a lot of the 4 years that I was there. They were in the top 25 almost, I think, every year. I had a start against them where I was really, really good through three or four innings. I was great, as a matter of fact. And I was doing it from the start with my changeup. I relied on it. I would throw it on 0-0. I would throw it on 2-0. I would throw it on 3-2. It didn't matter. I was getting them. I was mowing them down. And then came the fourth inning or so, and that changeup second time through the order, second 2.5 times through the order, it just doesn't look the same. And you can't throw it as good as you did the first time through, because now you've lost the element of surprise. And the fourth inning comes in, well, now you've given up a 5 spot, and that's the game. In a game like that, that's the game. If I had thrown the fastball through the order the first time, then we're talking about a changeup the second time that no one has seen that looks a whole lot better. It allows you to go deeper into the game for that perspective, or just for the variability in your pitch sequence. But then look at the other side. When guys throw curveballs, look at Pomeranz. We'll take Drew Pomeranz for an example. A curveball is by nature, because of the movement, it is a harder pitch to throw wherever you want. There's more movement, so therefore it's more unpredictable, and it's harder to locate than a straight pitch. So your percentage of strikes on a curveball is generally lower than your percentage of strikes on a fastball. So what does that mean? What does that translate to? If I'm going to throw more curveballs, they are harder to hit. So I'm going to get some more swings and misses. Counts are going to go on a little longer because there's going to be more strikeouts. They're also harder to locate. So if guys are taking them or guys aren't chasing them, I'm going to throw more balls. So there's going to be more walks. So you look at a guy like Drew Pomeranz, yeah, he could strike out 10, but he could also walk 4, and he could be done in the fifth inning because of his pitch count. And that is the MO for some of these guys. Lance McCullers in Houston. Rich Hill, who they don't trust to go through the order 3 times. Remember that? There's a big story in the playoffs last year. They don't trust Rich Hill in Los Angeles to go through the order a third time. Why? Because he doesn't have anything else but his curveball. They don't trust that. Pomeranz, to me, is the same. So it's really difficult for me to wrap my head around starting pitchers who are so breaking ball dominant and so breaking ball dependent. And this is fascinating, too, because in some cases, I think teams are employing those philosophies on guys that they shouldn't be. And Yankee fans, I think Sonny Gray is somebody the research bears out. He's throwing his fastball at a lower percentage than ever before, and his numbers have not been good this season. Now, there was a great column in Fangraphs, kind of a sabermetric baseball site, kind of the foremost authority in baseball sabermetrics, about Sonny Gray almost abandoning his fastball and how it's hurting him. And the woman who wrote that was by the name of Cheryl Ring, and I'm going to do my best to get her on tomorrow's show because this is all in my head now. You talk about breaking ball-dependent pitchers like Drew Pomeranz. I think the Yankees are starting to make Sonny Gray that way. And I don't think that it's working. All along, I thought it was a Sonny Gray problem where he simply didn't trust his stuff. Now I think it's a Yankees thing. They don't have outside of Severino, who throws 100 miles an hour, they are doing this a lot with a lot of their pitchers. Tanaka doesn't throw many fastballs. Gray doesn't throw many fastballs. It's very interesting. So I'm going to do my best to get Cheryl Ring from Fangraphs on tomorrow's show. And last thing here, and I want to tell any young baseball player who's listening, any youth coach, any high school coach, any father, anyone who's listening who has a son or a daughter that plays baseball and pitches, don't follow this recipe at a young age. It's one thing in the major leagues to abandon your fastball. It's another thing when you're 14. And that is what I started to do. I knew when I was younger, my curveball was my best pitch. Then I got to college and my changeup was my best pitch. I knew that I had really good off-speed stuff. And therefore, I said to myself, Brady, I want to get the most guys out. So I'm going to do what helps me get the most guys out. And that was just live on those pitches. And it helps you for an inning. It helps you for two innings. Maybe it helps you two times through the order. But it's hard to make a living at a young age. You know, it was the wrong approach for me to be scared of my fastball at a young age. You know what happens? You know how many people really take you deep when you're 16 years old? It's not many. You know, you're afraid to throw your fastball because you're afraid of getting hit. Well, you don't get hit that hard at 14 through 16. Learn how to pitch and learn how to use all those pitches together. I wish I would have done that. I wish I would have done that. If you want to get in, 802-655-6672. It is Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. We're about 10 minutes away from Bob Black, who's the voice of the Richmond Spiders and therefore saw all the games for Kyle Lauletta, the new quarterback for the Giants. But first, so we're getting ready for Game 2 tonight between the 76ers and the Celtics. And Julius Erving, 76ers legend, comes out today and says that probably Jason Tatum should have been the number one pick over Markelle Fultz. And it's certainly easy to say that because Fultz only played 14 games. He only averaged 7 points. He's been sat down completely for the last three games of the playoffs. And Jason Tatum, by the way, played in 80 games and averaged 14 points, and he's averaging 17 points a game in the playoffs. So, I mean, it's an easy hindsight is 20-20. But at the time, it's not even about who should have gone number one because the NFL is different than the NBA. The NFL, a lot of teams look at it and say, the draft is pick the best player available, we'll make the pieces work, and we're going to have a lot of attrition, so we're going to need multiple pieces at each position. The NBA, there's only five guys on the floor. It's more about fit and more about schematics. And, you know, Dave Gettleman said you don't draft on need in the NFL. In the NBA, you have to draft partly on need. So the Sixers had the number one pick. It made no sense for them to draft Jason Tatum. It made zero sense. I look at a Sixers team that in the offseason, I said, well, Saric is a big body. I mean, Jason Tatum's 6'8". Saric is in that height range. Is he going to take him over? Ben Simmons is 6'8", 6'9". Joel Embiid is 7 feet. They have big players there. What the Sixers needed was a young ball handler, okay? What they needed was a young scorer that could handle the rock, and that's what Markelle Fultz could do. He made way too much sense for them. What would have been very interesting was if the Celtics had held on to that number one pick, what they would have done. Because I remember sitting here 10 months ago and advocating for Jason Tatum. And I loved this kid out of college, and it had been proven right now, but that's not what it's about. The Celtics had a definitive need. The Celtics are small. They're still small. Al Horford's their biggest player at 6'10". Jason Tatum at 6'8 helps give them some size. Now, Jason Tatum has played more of a perimeter role, I think, than I was expecting, especially initially. He's been better from the outside. But at the time, I thought he gave them some more height, could help them in the rebounding battle. He did get 5 boards a game this year for a team that struggled on the glass last season. And he gives them some size. And, oh, by the way, this team had Isaiah Thomas at the time. And Isaiah Thomas was a scoring guard. What they didn't have was support players that could be perimeter-oriented. If you bring in Markelle Fultz, he doesn't play over Isaiah Thomas. He sits behind Isaiah Thomas and helps give Isaiah Thomas relief. Now, there's value in that. I could have made the case for Fultz to be number one in Boston. But if the better move all along was Tatum, because Isaiah Thomas needed some scoring help on the perimeter. Isaiah Thomas breaks everybody down, kicks to the corner, and there's Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum for him. That was the thought process. And then defensively at 6'8 and long, he helps you play defense and he helps you get rebounds. So for Dr. J to say that Tatum should have been the number one pick over Fultz, it's really apples and oranges. The Sixers didn't need a 6'8 wing player. They needed a ball-dominant guard that could play, make, and get balls, you know, number one, score on the perimeter. Number two, be a secondary ball handler to Ben Simmons. And number three is the right height for their lineup, what they're trying to do. The Celtics, they needed a bigger body. That's why Tatum was always the better fit to me than Fultz. Again, I could have justified Fultz, you know, give Thomas some relief. If you don't re-sign Thomas, then Fultz comes in. You could have justified it. But to me, it was always better for Jason Tatum. And when they had the number one pick, I thought you could make a case for it. When they had number three, I thought it was a definite. It's Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN at 101.3ESPN.com. We talked earlier in the week about what the Patriots did at the quarterback position in the draft, and it wasn't much, taking Danny Etling out of LSU. The Giants, they addressed the quarterback position too. They took Kyle Lauletta out of Richmond in the fourth round. What do we make of that selection? Giant fans, you'll be sure to listen in. Bob Black, voice of the Richmond Spiders. He joins us next on Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3.
It's Champlain Valley Game Night with Brady Farkas, only on 101.3 ESPN.
Welcome back to Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. NFL draft now a few days in the rearview mirror, but that doesn't mean the speculation and the grading process of the draft is over. And this week we're spending a lot of time talking about quarterbacks. We talked about Danny Etling of LSU, who the Patriots took in the seventh round earlier in the week. Now we talk about Kyle Lauletta, the guy from Richmond who the Giants took in the fourth round, who we thought maybe the Patriots were going to take. Let's go out to the TikTok Jewelers guest line now and find ourselves Bob Black, longtime play-by-play announcer for Richmond football. So he saw a lot of play. Bob, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you joining us as well. A lot of Giant fans in this area, and a lot of Giant fans split. Some of them said Eli's got a couple years left. Give him the playmaking running back and Saquon Barkley. Other people said they needed a quarterback early on. They go with the running back. They take Kyle Lauletta in the fourth round. We don't know if he's the heir apparent to Eli Manning, but from your vantage point, how good is he?
Well, we would certainly like to think he is the heir apparent to Eli Manning. He was tremendous at the FCS level, but I will tell you that in the games that Richmond played against FBS teams, he was also very good. So he was able to stack up against some of the better competition. He will not blow you away with arm strength, but he has tremendous accuracy. He can throw into a tight window. He is renowned in our parts for film study, for amount of time he spends in front of the tape machine, scouting opponents, scouting himself, very good in the huddle. And I will also tell you this, he is going to win the fans and he is going to win the press conferences. Now, he's also going to be a winner on the field, but he is extremely intelligent and a very articulate young man.
Now, you can tell he's articulate because he wrote a really nice letter to all 32 GMs that was featured in the Players Tribune, and where he talked about kind of what makes him special. And it just feels like, at least for the work ethic part of things, it seems like the Giants got themselves a good one.
Correct. I think the work ethic part could be unparalleled with him. You know, he's been a little bit of an underdog throughout his career, whether that was at the high school level or coming to Richmond and not really getting a whole lot of attention from any of the FBS schools. So I think there's a little bit of a chip on his shoulder to go along with the work ethic. We had him on our show in Richmond on Tuesday morning, and he admitted that he thought he was going to go in the third round, that before he went to sleep on Friday night, he was going to have been drafted and not have one more sleepless night. So I think that gave him a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. He was taken relatively early on the Saturday, on day three, round four, so he didn't have to wait too long. But I think in his mind, it'll keep that chip on his shoulder a little bit about going in the fourth round instead of maybe a little bit earlier.
You know, one of the guy he's going to be competing with to be Eli Manning's backup is Davis Webb out of Cal, who the Giants took last year. And one of the things that Kyle LaLetta wrote in that letter was that he's seen all the offenses you could throw at him. He's made all the throws. And we always talk about, well, could Davis Webb, you know, can these air raid system quarterbacks adjust to life in the NFL? What kind of offense were they playing at Richmond? Because LaLetta seems confident he's an easy adjustment to the NFL.
Well, it kind of depends on what year you ask about, because what was maybe a detraction for Kyle and a frustration during his career at Richmond, I think he is now turning into a positive. And that is that he had four offensive coordinators in his 5 years at Richmond, including his redshirt year. So he learned a variety of offenses. They were all somewhat similar. I will tell you, in his last year, in his senior year, it probably deviated a little bit more than it had in the other years with a coaching staff change in its entirety. So he has picked up on several different offenses, and the Giants offense, what they've been running anyway with Eli Manning, is similar to the offenses that Kyle ran at Richmond.
I don't think people realize, and we're talking with Bob Black, voice of Richmond football and basketball, here with us on Champlain Valley Game Night 101.3 ESPN. I don't think people realize just how good FCS football is. I used to work in Albany, so I've seen and covered Albany football, so I've seen and covered Richmond against UAlbany as well. But people still have this stigma that, oh, if you're not playing in the Pac-12 or the SEC, then you must not be any good. Well, with Joe Flacco a few years ago coming in and playing well and winning a Super Bowl, and Carson Wentz playing very, very well and playing at an MVP-type level last year, has it gotten easier for FCS QBs in particular to kind of crack through those stigmas?
Yeah, I don't know how much easier it's gotten yet, because I do think it is still out there. The other advantage that a school like Richmond and a player like Kyle has at the FCS level is that he competed in arguably the best conference in FCS. I think in the Colonial Athletic Association, and from your time at Albany, you would know that, they certainly like to pound their chest and say they're the best conference. Now, North Dakota State winning all the championships they've won, they're going to make an argument out there as well. But James Madison and Richmond and Villanova's won a national championship, and Delaware is consistently year in and year out very good as well. I think that helps. And the CAA is a conference that is just loaded with outstanding quarterbacks. Normally the most successful teams at the CAA FCS level have prolific quarterbacks. They're not winning championships necessarily with the old cliche of defense wins championships. They're winning it with a guy who can pull the trigger at quarterback.
Bob, we'll get you out of here on this. And if the name Bob Black is triggering any kind of memories with our listeners, it's because, Bob, you were on our station a few months ago during basketball season. You were on the pregame show for UVM and Richmond, which was an early season test for the Catamounts. And UVM was pretty darn good in that showing, and they won that game. Were you surprised at how good the Catamounts were when they came to Richmond?
No, actually, I don't think we were. I think we were pretty familiar with the history and what they have done. We were probably a little bit more surprised that we didn't see them in the NCAA tournament,
quite frankly,
than we were about how they played that night. I think our fans were impressed, but I think those of us that follow college basketball knew what was coming that night, and we're extremely respectful of that program and just how good they have been and certainly will continue to be.
Bob Black, voice of Richmond Spiders athletics as a whole, football and basketball, with us on Champlain Valley Game Night. Lots of good stuff out of there about Kyle LaLetta. Giant fans, I think, intrigued by his selection in the fourth round of last weekend's NFL draft. Bob, thank you so much for the time.
I really think that they will go from intrigued to really liking that pick for the New York Giants. So we wish them the best of luck there, and thanks for having me on.
Of course. There he goes, Bob Black. Yeah, Giant fans, how are you feeling about the pick? 802-655-6672. As the days have gone on, the draft grades have continued to come out, and people say the Giants nailed the draft. And look, the players are all speculative. We don't know which of these players are going to pan out. So that's not – I never like to say, oh, I love that pick in particular. I always just look at the positions that they took. I like what the Giants did in the draft with limited resources. They only had 6 picks. They came into the draft with the fewest amount of picks in the draft. They did get a running back, which they needed. They did get a quarterback, maybe of the future, which they needed. Nonetheless, they needed at least to ensure they have a good backup. We think they did that. They took 3 linemen, 2 on the offensive line, or 2 on the defensive line, 1 on the offensive line. I have to like what the Giants did. And on Kyle Lauletta, I'm intrigued by him. A guy who's big, I think 6'3 or so, can make all the throws, won't wow you with arm strength, as Bob said, but if you have a cerebral quality to you, a work ethic to you, and you can make all the throws, then I'm at least interested in giving you a shot. I'm at least interested. How do Giant fans feel? You can get in 802-655-6672 on the Town Fair Tire text line. Some notes real quick that came out today. Albert Breer, Monday Morning Quarterback, was talking about the Patriots and why they didn't take a quarterback. And they were talking about Lamar Jackson in particular, because that was a guy we had heard also, in addition to Kyle Lauletta, linked to the Pats. And the criticism, or maybe the questions, rather, that the Patriots might have had in Albert Breer's mind were simply this. If the Patriots were to flip their offense upside down for him, would he hold up? Jackson isn't built like Cam Newton or Ben Roethlisberger, so that was a potential far-reaching problem. If you had to run him 10 to 15 times a game to make the offense go. So I don't think he was much of a consideration at 23 or 31. I think that's fair. I said that my biggest worry about Lamar Jackson was, could you coach the instinct out of him? And the instinct is to be a playmaker. And the way he can make a play is with his arm and with his legs. And sometimes, you know, that first read's not there. Then you just take off, and you're used to being able to blow by everybody and juke a couple guys, and there's 25 yards for you and something spectacular. You can't live that way in the NFL. Cam Newton is much thicker than Lamar Jackson, and they're trying to coach that out of him to keep him safe and keep him healthy and keep him in the face of the franchise. It's a fair concern if the Patriots said, we don't want to totally adjust our offense for a guy we're not sure that we can play that way. We're not sure that we can, if we're going to put him out there to be the most successful quarterback he can be, we need to adopt some of his tendencies. And we're not sure he's going to hold up doing that. I think it's a perfectly valid complaint, a perfectly valid question to ask. I really do. I think it's fair. And it would have been a complete role reversal on that Patriots offense. It would have been, the Patriots have never played under Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels, have never played with a college-type quarterback. They never have. So you would be talking about 20 years worth of offensive principles for Belichick and then another 10 plus for McDaniels being thrown completely out the window to suit Lamar Jackson. Now, you need to be able to adapt as a coach. Not everybody fits your little box, but you are picking these players. So if you have a system you like, you can pick players directly to you that can fit what you do. It would have been a total deviation from anything. Look at who the Patriots have had play quarterback. They've had Drew Bledsoe, an immobile statue, Tom Brady, a largely immobile statue, Matt Castle, a largely immobile statue, Jimmy Garoppolo, a guy who could get outside, and they utilized some play action and things with him, but he was a really accurate passer. Lamar Jackson's not at that level right now with that accuracy. Were they going to tailor an offense completely to Lamar Jackson? I don't know. I think it would have been a hard sell for a guy that you're not sure could hold up in that style. Very interesting. So love the quarterback talk. You can always get on 802-655-6672. Yankees with a big comeback win today. Remember, Red Sox baseball comes up at 7:20. They take on the Rangers. We'll give you those lineups about 15 minutes from now. When we come back, I'll get into the keys for the Celtics today. I'll say goodbye to Ichiro, and we'll give you those Red Sox lineups. That's all next, Champlain Valley Game Night. Coming up, 101.3 ESPN.
Champlain Valley Game Night with Brady Farkas, only on 101.3 ESPN.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. Going up until 7 o'clock, full show today. Remember, Red Sox baseball, 7:20. We'll have those lineups for you 10 minutes from now. David Price on the mound in Arlington. Yankees already winners today to take 3 of 4 from the world champion Astros. Yankees look really good right now. They've won 12 of their last 13. They're outscoring opponents 79-25 in that time frame. So unbelievable two-week stretch for the Bronx Bombers. Celtic basketball game two against the 76ers on AM 960. The Zone today. Coverage starts at 8 o'clock. If you want to get in, you can. 802-655-6672. We get a couple of texts from earlier in the show. Brady, Ben Simmons is tall, but his strength is being a ball handler. Jason Tatum would have been a great fit for Philly. Fultz takes the balls out of Simmons' hands, and that's not a good thing. Look, I understand what you're saying there, but you look at the size of people that the Sixers have between Saric, between Bellinelli, between Embiid. There's just too many big-bodied, perimeter-oriented players there. Markelle Fultz at least gives the Sixers a secondary ball handler and an option to be a scoring guard off ball. Think of the same way LeBron and Kyrie Irving were. Kyrie Irving is small, but he was able to play largely a two-guard position because LeBron would dominate ball possession. Now, you could say that's not the way basketball should be played and that, you know, LeBron shouldn't have handled the ball as much as he did, but that won the Cavaliers a title and got them to three consecutive titles. So, or three consecutive championship series against the Golden State Warriors. So I think Fultz is still a better pick in Philly. Someone else comes in. Brady, Josh McDaniels had Tim Tebow in Denver, and Josh McDaniels was ready to replace Tim Tebow in Denver instantly. And if you had Josh McDaniels to give truth serum, I don't think he ever would have wanted Tim Tebow to play, period. So, but you are right. Your point's well taken. He has run an offense for a run-first instinctual quarterback for a period of games. What was it, 10 games or whatever? That's it. That's it. 8 games, 10 games, whatever it was. They're much – Bill Belichick, Josh McDaniels are much more comfortable being with pocket passers, and Lamar Jackson at this point in his career is not that. All right, so before we get to those Red Sox lineups and before I talk about Ichiro for a second, keys to the Celtics tonight is really – for me, it's simple. Withstand what the Sixers do early on in the game. Because the Sixers are going to come out, I have to imagine, with a lot of intensity. Offensively, they shot horrible, 5 for 26 from 3. You can't count on them to be that bad. They're going to hit more threes. They're going to shoot a better percentage than, you know, what amounts to about less than 20%. They're going to shoot a better percentage than that from 3. Defensively, I think they're going to be engaged because it wasn't necessarily – Brad Stevens schemed a lot of buckets, but the Sixers' lack of intensity on defense also played a role. So I think the Sixers are going to come out really aggressive. They're going to come out with their length, with their speed, with their youth, with their energy. They're going to try to rattle the Celtics early. And I don't know if that's even possible under Brad Stevens, but they're going to try to overwhelm them early. Key for the Celtics is withstand that early barrage. Think about what happened to the Bruins yesterday. The Bruins, we talk about how you start the game is going to dictate a lot of how the game goes, and instantly Tampa Bay comes out, overwhelms them with an onslaught of shots, and gets up 2-0 4 minutes into the game, and that was all she wrote right there. Now, the NBA, it's a little easier to come back than the NHL, but if you are talking about a Sixers team that gets up 27-9 right off the bat, then you're in trouble. If the Celtics can withstand that barrage and play well early and keep it within striking distance at the half, then they're in a golden position. The Celtics under Brad Stevens this playoffs have been really good at halftime adjustments. They are outscoring opponents by 32 points in the second half and overtime. They are outscoring opponents by 32 points in the second half and overtime. If I'm going to pencil in that you're going to play better in the second half than the first half, then all I need you to do is stay pretty close. Stay pretty close. You can't have a halftime score of 67-48. Can't have that. But you could have a halftime score of, you know, 60-56. Just keep it close. Withstand that early barrage and then play basketball. Because the Sixers, to me, if they're going, their best game plan right now for me today, come out and try to overwhelm Boston. And do it with your speed. Do it with your length. Do it with your size. Get J.J. Redick going. He's been your best scorer in majority of the playoffs. get him going, get Joel Embiid going, and let's take it from there. Because that, to me, is a winning formula for Brett Brown and company. Brad Stevens just has to say, look, let's withstand the initial onslaught, and then let's play basketball. And then you can start to see the schematics of what Brad Stevens does and getting Marco Bellinelli in pick and rolls. When Marco Bellinelli was playing, he was on the floor for 28 minutes in game one. The Celtics scored 129 points per 100 possessions when he was on the floor. Now, those numbers might not mean a lot to everybody. Heck, they don't even mean everything to me. But just know that they scored at an absurd rate when Marco Bellinelli was on the floor. And they exposed him. They exposed him in pick and rolls with Al Horford. They exposed him with Shane Larkin when he was in the game. Terry Rozier was open shot after open shot created in pick and roll situations. A lot of it because of what Brad Stevens did. If you can withstand the early onslaught and keep it close, then that stuff starts to take over as the game goes on. Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. So I started off the show talking about this. Ichiro is not officially retired, but nonetheless, he's not playing at all in 2018. He's at an agreement with the Mariners where he will not play for the team in 2018. He will transition to a front office role. He is not officially retired. He could play for another team in 2019. He could play for the Mariners in 2019. But to me, it feels like the end of Ichiro. And at the very least, it feels like the end of Ichiro with the Mariners. And an amazing career. I mean, this is a guy who's hit a career 311. He's got 3,000-plus hits in America alone. You add that to another 1,000-plus in Japan. He stole 81% of the bases that he attempted to. He had 800 RBIs despite playing out of the leadoff spot most of his career. He was incredible. He's got the most hits ever in a single season, 262, 10 gold gloves, 10 all-star games, 2 batting titles, an MVP, rookie of the year. One of the guys that has just had one of the most full trophy cases in baseball history. A generational player. We may never see anything like him. And for me, I simply want to say thank you, because I joke about this a lot. The Mariners have been bad most of my life. Since 2001, Ichiro's rookie year, they have not made the playoffs since. Ichiro is 44 years old. They haven't made the playoffs since he was 27. The longest drought in the four major sports. They have not only been bad, they've been horrible for a lot of those years. And the years when they had Ichiro, they were awful too. Except for the one year they made the playoffs in 01, they were pretty bad a lot of those times too. And when you're a guy who was 15 years old and 17 years old, and we bought the MLB Extra Innings package, and I would stay up till 1 in the morning to watch the Mariners lose more often than not, Ichiro was sometimes the only reason to keep watching. And Ichiro never struck the chord with me that Ken Griffey Jr. did, because Griffey, I saw him play in person. I saw him when I was younger and when it was more formative for me. His highlight, he had that personality where you could connect with him. Ichiro was sheltered. He never let you in, so therefore I never super attached to him. But I recognize how special he is, how special he was, and I recognize that for me, for a decade that is really the lost years of Mariners baseball, he was the only reason to watch. Him and Felix Hernandez were it. They were definitely the only two reasons to watch. And more often than not, Ichiro was it. And I'll never forget it, though. It was early in Ichiro's career. It was probably about 2002 or 3. And my dad and I went to Yankee Stadium, and the Mariners were playing, and there was a Japanese tour bus there to watch Ichiro. And there were we were right next to him, and there was this whole crowd of Japanese people, and they would scream, "Case, Fa, Ichiro," every time. And I think it was probably "Let's go, Ichiro," is my guess. I don't know, but that's my guess. And I'll never forget that, and that's something that my dad and I joke about this day. So, to this day. So, thank you to Ichiro for making the Mariners watchable for a decade. Thank you for the accomplishments that you had. Thank you for, I mean, it was a gift to watch him hit. And thank you to that lifelong memory now that I have with my dad. And I appreciate that, and I love that memory, and I love that game, and I'll never forget that game solely because of that. I don't remember if the Mariners won or lost. I don't remember who pitched. I don't remember if Ichiro had a hit. But I remember that Japanese tour bus, every time he came to the plate, screaming, "Case Fa Ichiro," and that's now a lifelong memory that I have with my dad, and I appreciate that. And then, you know, you think about it, and for a decade, Ichiro was the only guy I would trust in a late-game situation. He's the only guy that I would trust in a clutch situation because I knew he wasn't going to strike out. I knew he was, I don't know if he was going to get a hit, but I knew he was going to make the pitcher work for it. And that, to me, gave me confidence as a fan, even in all his downtrodden years. So it's ironic that last night I'm watching the Mariners and the A's, and the Mariners blew that game six ways to Sunday, but they lose 3-2. And they've got runners at first and second with one out in the ninth, and Ichiro comes to the plate, and he struck out, and he was overwhelmed on a fastball. And it's ironic to me that for all those years, he's the only guy I wanted up. And then yesterday, he was probably the guy I wanted up the least in that situation. You've just seen it this year that he's not the same. And it hurts to see that when the legends become not the same. I remember when I realized it about Griffey, got used as a pinch hitter for the White Sox, and he got blown away with 93-mile-an-hour fastballs of Tampa Bay in an AL wildcard game. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was painful. And I just was sad yesterday. I was hoping so much for Ichiro to get that game-winning hit yesterday, or a game-tying hit. It just didn't happen. It just made me sad. So I'm happy if he does retire that I got to see him for a decade in Seattle, plus a little bit more this year. I appreciate the good memories. I appreciate the memory he gave me with my dad. And he's truly a player that we'll never see again. We will never see a player like Ichiro again. Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. Enough sappiness. Red Sox, Rangers coming your way from Arlington. That coverage starts at 7:20. Lineups, Sox come in 22-8. Rangers in last place in the AL West at 12-20. David Price is on the mound, 2-3. With a 3.78 ERA for Boston, struggled his last time out, gave up 5 earned in a loss to the Rays. The lineup behind him, Mookie Betts in right field, 3.65 in an AL tying lead in homers. He's got 11. Hanley Ramirez hits second and plays first. JD Martinez is in left and hits third. Xander Bogaerts is at short. He hits cleanup. Rafael Devers is at third, hitting fifth. Eduardo Nunez is at second. Blake Swihart gets in the lineup today for the first time in a while. He is the DH. Christian Vasquez is the catcher, and Jackie Bradley Jr. is in center field. Mike Minor, again, the pitcher for the Rangers, 2-1 with a 4.33. He's got a winning record despite the team being 8 games under. Delino DeShields, the speedy center fielder, he leads off. Shin-Soo Chu, he is the DH, he hits second. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, he hits third and plays second. Nomar Mazara is in right, the slugging outfielder. Joey Gallo, slugger, 10 homers. A lot of strikeouts, though. 10 homers, 22 RBIs. He hits fifth and plays first. The once-upon-a-time great prospect, Jurickson Profar, the switch hitter, is at shortstop. Renato Nunez is at third. Robinson Chirinos is the catcher. He hits eighth. And Ryan Rua, hitting just 204, he is in left and bats ninth. All right, that will do it for us. Thank you to Bob Black, voice of the Richmond Spiders, for joining us here in Champlain Valley Game Night. Red Sox baseball is next. Celtics basketball, 8 o'clock. Over on AM 960 The Zone, they're taking on the Sixers, looking to get that 2-0 series lead. We're back at it tomorrow, everybody. Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN, 101.3ESPN.com. And remember, download the 101.3 ESPN app because we're always streaming. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody, and it'll be a Friday, so it'll be a good one.
Go Lake and Wingo.
Well, based on how much I talked up the Cavs on